For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, Bodhisattvas. Thank you very much for coming together for a little romping and playing in samadhi this evening. Congratulations to Wade in his debut as a Kokyo, having to chant the nonsensical Japanese Heart Sutra. It was not some kind of test for you. But I wish I was that devious, but so I want us to chant something heartfelt in Japanese, because tonight I'd like to, in part, pay homage to our Japanese-American Buddhist very near ancestors. And the Heart Sutra is something that probably almost every Japanese Buddhist has some connection to. I've been wondering about a lot of things. And lately I've been thinking about, wondering about wisdom, the great Buddhist topic, you know, prajna paramita. What is wisdom? How is it working in this world? And one of the places that a Buddhist might be able to research wisdom is in the great prajna paramita canon of literature, right? So these are some of the older Buddhist, new school Buddhist sutras that teach, you know, this idea of form is none other than emptiness, emptiness is none other than form. But emptiness is the opposite of nothingness. And, you know, prajna is really like, really means like pre-knowledge. Before we start categorizing and separating things into categories, before we start building walls and fences, there's some truth in our hearts, which is what the Buddha taught. So I think about how this works in our world and how we live from this prajna-ing, this knowing before dualism. And also some of that study entails looking at what happens when we get caught in dualistic ideas of other and start to build these kind of fences or fence people in. So, you know, just FYI, the short version of prajna paramita, this great transcendent wisdom before knowing anything, which is the great Zen project, you know. How do we, you know, everything we're doing is sort of to try to get into this state of samadhi or this state of knowing. And we have all these little vehicles like, you know, what were your original face before your parents were born? You know, Zazen, where we're not holding on to anything. These are all little techniques to direct us towards this heart, prajna. I will mention that the Prajna Paramita Sutra, so this word sutra, right, is Buddha's words. So these are Buddha's spoken words are contained in a sutra. That's a very special kind of Buddhist term. Originally, of course, these sutras were Buddha's words that were spoken to his attendant Ananda, who remembered all of them, then wrote them down. But somehow, sometimes sutras appear mysteriously throughout time. There's even a Smokey the Bear Sutra. I don't know if everybody heard of that one by Gary Snyder. But it doesn't begin with the words that most sutras begin with, which is, thus have I heard. The reason they all begin with this, thus have I heard, is because they're being repeated by someone else who heard the Buddha's words, typically Ananda. So you know you've got a sutra happening when you see that sutra starting with thus have I heard. And like I said, although the Buddha, you know, during his lifetime spoke what are sort of seen as kind of the original sutras, but hundreds and maybe thousands of years later, sometimes sutras appear mysteriously. So these Prajnaparamita sutras actually appeared closer to, you know, the beginning of the first millennium, somewhere around there, many hundreds of years after Buddha apparently passed away. And this hymn to the perfection of wisdom that we chanted actually comes from the Ashtasahasrika Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is a sutra in 8,000 lines. So that's actually in the chapter called Hell. There's a chapter called Hell, and apparently you're going to be in big trouble if you don't have faith in this sutra. So maybe you go to hell. But remember, the sutra removes all suffering. So it's a great thing that we've chanted it. So there's this kind of precog aspect to wisdom. So in thinking about sutras and modern sutras, a couple months ago, I heard about this book entitled An American Sutra. If anybody's seen this, written by Duncan Williams. Duncan Williams is a brilliant scholar, if I may say so. Hope that doesn't offend you, Duncan. But he's also a Soto Zen priest, and he grew up in Japan. I think his father was English and his mother's Japanese. But he spent his life, you know, formative years in Japan and became a Zen Buddhist priest, Soto Zen Buddhist priest. It's kind of interesting. But I was like, whoa, that's a pretty serious title to call your book a sutra. It's like, I need to find out more about this. And it turned out he was having a book reading at a Buddhist temple. And if some people from this temple were here, Dylan was there. You weren't there, were you, Matt? But there were a couple other people. Ed, I think, was there. Dylan and I went together. And it brought up a lot for me. Mostly gratitude and some sadness. So this is a story, or this is a collection of stories of the experience of Japanese American Buddhists who were interned during World War II. 110,000. And I knew a little of this history, but one of the points Duncan Williams makes is that Japanese Buddhists were especially targeted because of being of a Buddhist faith. You were the heathens in our Christian world in the 40s. And, you know, almost immediately after the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, already the U.S. government had been considering the, quote, Japs, and especially the Buddhist Japs. And these were, you know, quotes, so excuse me using that language, but that was the language. And I think it's good to face this. This is the side of Prajna where you don't turn away from things, but see them as they are. We're seeing, and especially the Buddhists, the first people who were arrested in Hawaii were Buddhist priests. And already there were lists of who these people were and their families. And I would say something like 90% of the Buddhists in America, or the Japanese in America, in Hawaii, and mostly in Hawaii, California, but they were Buddhist. And Buddhism, you know, I don't know if anybody here has practiced at all in a temple that is primarily for Japanese American Buddhists. Has anybody hung out in those kind of environs. It's very rare, actually, to have a Japanese-American Buddhist show up in a place like this. But the Japanese Buddhist temples in Chicago that I've experienced are community centers, essentially. They're very warm places. There's often no zazen because many of them practice a different form of Buddhism. But I immediately bought this book. Duncan Williams signed it. And I said, oh, here's a new sutra. Let's check this out. So many things I could say about this, but I'll just say that it begins. The first title of the first section is, Thus Have I Heard, an American Sutra. I'm like, thus have I heard. What is going on, you know? These are the words of Buddha. That's what thus have I heard means. So then it goes on a little further. Need my glasses to read this. Thank you. Am I destroying that? I'm sorry. Okay, thanks. Starts with a little poem. Thus have I heard, the army ordered all Japanese faces to be evacuated from the city of Los Angeles. This homeless monk has nothing but a Japanese face. He stayed here 13 springs meditating with all faces from all parts of the world and studied the teaching of the Buddha with them. Wherever he goes, he may form other groups, inviting friends of all faces, beckoning them with the empty hands of Zen. This was a poem by Nyogen Senzaki. And, you know, I know that Brian's been kind of studying a little of our heritage, too, so maybe you'll have some comments later, and certainly everyone. But does everyone know who Nyogen Senzaki is? So, you know, just so I can share what my understanding of Nyogen Senzaki is. So Nyogen Senzaki is an interesting Japanese character. He was a Buddhist priest whose teacher took him to San Francisco and then abandoned him in the early 1900s and said, hang out in the US, good luck. And he actually lived near San Francisco Zen Center early in his career, before San Francisco Zen Center even existed. Because actually where San Francisco Zen Center is now on Page Street in San Francisco was a Jewish women's residence, as far as I remember. But Senzaki lived very poorly. He took odd jobs, but he was just teaching Zen all over the place. He called himself the Mushroom Monk. And he eventually ended up in Los Angeles. And Robert Aitken, who's a very famous Zen teacher, was influenced by Senzaki, and Senzaki brought over another priest friend of his who had a very large influence in this world. But Senzaki, this is written in 1942, so he was already relocated, courtesy of the American government, to a camp. But this is what he wrote, inviting friends of all faces. Just kind of blows me away. And then I was sort of going, you know, wow, there's so many parallels to what is happening now and what happened then in terms of people on the basis of their race, but then that was multiplied by being a part of a religion that was non-Christian, which got them into big trouble and big oppression. So I just want to honor the faith and practice of these Japanese people who, in some ways, we often don't even know how they influenced our practice. I think I'll say a little bit about how they influenced mine and how World War II, in a weird way, influenced me. So I never studied with a Japanese Zen teacher. As my teacher. But I was thinking, when did I first have a feeling about the Japanese. And I remember this experience I had when I was very young, and I know at least 3 years old, but probably a little older, this memory happened. I lived in a town called Boca Raton, Florida, and there were many retired military people in Boca Raton, Florida. Later, IBM built its plant where they developed the PC there. But there weren't many kids. There were a lot of old people. Or they seemed old. Now they're like probably seem young to me. But and next door lived a woman named Mrs. Stoll. And she was a former English teacher. And her husband was General Stoll. And General Stoll had been a major general in the US Air Force. And he was in charge of moving stuff around, supplies, the supply chain, during World War II in various places overseas. And the Stolls had this collection of very interesting objets, you know, knickknacks kind of, but they were amazing knickknacks. And I remember very distinctly looking at a small sword. There must have been some kind of sword. And I asked Mrs. Stoll and the general what this, that's what we called him, the general. he loved doing crossword puzzles. What this was. And this sword, General Stoll told the story that when he was moving supplies around, there had been a Japanese high-ranking officer killed in the war. And he had the body packed in ice and flew it himself back to Japan because he knew that the Japanese people had special ceremonies around their death. And in Buddhism, there's a way to sit with the body for 3 days at least after it dies, packed in ice, before it's cremated. And they gave General Stoll this ancestral sword. But in reflecting on it, I thought, you know, that's a small sword. It had a jade handle, a white jade handle. And it made me very curious about the Japanese people, but also like I thought of General Stoll, this fierce person who somehow did this act of kindness in the middle of war. It's bizarre. And it made me fear him less. But in reflecting on that sword, I have a suspicion that that was probably a sword that was used for a ritual disembowelment called seppuku, because usually samurai swords are very large. But that gave me the first idea of what a Japanese person was, and to honor those people, even if they were, quote, the enemy, although I didn't think they were the enemy at the time, they were just Japanese people. I didn't really grow up with World War II, so I wasn't too tuned into that, especially at like 6 or 7. Later, in Chicago in the 80s, I'd been practicing meditation most of my life, even prior to then, but there's a temple in Uptown, and there was a teacher there named Reverend Kubosei. And Kubosei was the first person I sat zazen with. And he was a Japanese-American Buddhist priest of the Jodo Shinshu variety, which is not Zen, but he'd actually been to, he studied Zen meditation in Japan, and he would go and do his Jodo Shinshu services for his group downstairs. And then he would hop upstairs and invite all these like white Americans to sit zazen with him. Because we weren't interested in the Jodo Shinshu, you know, they sang songs, it looked like a church. It's called the Buddhist Churches of America or something. But Kubosei, he was already probably in his 70s by then. I never knew this, but he was also interned in World War II at the same place that Senzaki was, as a matter of fact, Heart Mountain in Wyoming. So one thing about Kubosei was that he just flitted from this Japanese community to the Americans seamlessly, like a little, he's a wispy little guy. And he would wear like a kind of a suit to do his Jodo Shinshu things with a little stole, which is kind of like a rakusu. But then he'd put on this like shabby little kimono over his little suit and sit zazen with us. And he actually taught the Heart Sutra and wrote a book on it called The Center Within. And I thought, these are not intellectual experiences of prajna, of the activity of wisdom, because they're heartfelt, deeply kind experiences. Both General Stoll, who was this large man, he seemed huge to me. Maybe he was only like 6'2 or something, but he looked like a giant to a child. And then this little sprite of a person called Kubose. And I sat there on and off for maybe, I don't know, 10 years. So the history in this American Sutra isn't easy to read. You know, it's the FBI rounding up Japanese Buddhist priests, families desperately burying, burning, destroying, hiding ritual items, Buddhist items, and anything that had Japanese correspondence, anything that looked Japanese was suspect. So like the feds would come in and ruffle through somebody's house and say, oh, look, this is Japanese writing, you know, or this is some Buddhist implement. And that meant that they were, you know, traitors. There was this paranoid description, even written like in the New York Times, of the fifth column of the enemy. You know, this like, do you know what the fifth column is? So this is a term actually that's used nowadays, that they think that like, you know, some people think there's a fifth column in the U.S. of U.S. citizens who are conspiring against the country. So a fifth column is like another, it was a term, I didn't realize it came from World War II because it was used recently, but it's like the enemy. This is the opposite of the Heart Sutra, right? The other, the enemy. So maybe it is hell if we don't have faith and exposure to this wisdom. You know, lurking within our countries, you know, behind our doors, the Japs. American Buddhist temples were vandalized and burned. Everybody who was taken away these camps, most of them lost all of their land, so they were farmers. So even though they were gone only a couple years, 2 or 3 years, when they came back, they had nothing. As a matter of fact, 20,000 got shipped to Chicago when they released them from the camps. I don't know if you know this, but like Clark Street, there's even a Nisei bar, which Nisei means second generation, in Wrigleyville. But like Clark Street used to be kind of the ghetto. But you know, because they couldn't go back to California for multiple reasons, a lot of them got shipped here and other places. So they were dislocated. In the camps, the Japanese were, you know, intentionally like fed stuff like pork and beans. And we might not think that's not so bad, but to a Japanese not to have rice, which is a readily available staple, because that was seen as, you know, the food of the great Eastern demon or something. So in addition to like these relocation camps, which actually were referred to in government documents as concentration camps, this even features an executive order. Remember, we recently had an executive order from the President of the United States called, it was a Muslim ban, but remember there was no speaking in that order, if you read it, of a Muslim. Same here. Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 on February 14, 1942. It had no mention of race or of religion, but it was targeted towards Japanese Buddhists. So I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. And then in March, March of 42, there was the War Relocation Act, which created camps. So everybody was put on trains and transported to these camps, such as this one Heart Mountain in Wyoming. There were quite a few of them. I find it really interesting that despite the fact that Buddhism was really suspect, Senzaki and Kubose both conducted Buddhist practice and services in these camps. So there was a lot of courage, and their Buddhist faith really got them through this very difficult time. Another interesting tidbit which struck me was there is a theme in Buddhism, especially Asian Buddhism. Remember, why did Bodhidharma come from the West, right? Which is a great koan. But there's this idea of the faith, of faith in Japanese American Buddhism, but also in Japanese Buddhism and in Chinese, that Buddhism is moving across the world. And so some of these Japanese American Buddhists even saw their being relocated and embedded in American soil as part of this eastward movement, bringing Buddhism to the world. And that's one way they gave meaning. So Senzaki also wrote a little poem that says, "This morning, the winding train, a big black snake, takes us as far as Wyoming. The current of Buddhist thought always runs eastward. Will this policy support the tendency of the teaching? Who knows?" but I'm like, you know, imagine that. So I think about this and I think, you know, can we face whatever comes to us without a dualistic mind, categorizing, separating, grabbing onto, pushing away, to support the teaching? You know, how do we honor our debt to people like Senzaki and so many beings that are considered other and see the workings of our interconnectedness? You know, I sincerely hope that our American Buddhist path, that our sutra is being written now in our own practice. We write it together here at Ancient Dragon and in our lives, where we take what whatever Zazen might contribute to our lives and hopefully express that. You know, I hope we can honor the pain and oppression of our Japanese American Buddhist ancestors, and that there's a tenderness towards that, that it's not just this dispassion, but it's heartbreaking to read this. It's heartbreaking. So many things are heartbreaking, but it's only, you know, as I think Aishin was talking about on Sunday, it's only with this brokenness, broken heart, that there's room for some kind of healing. You know, healing the wounds of duality. So I think it's okay that we feel sad about suffering or angry about injustice. And maybe that tenderness creates an opening for prajna, paramita, also known as the mother of all Buddhas. So I guess, you know, and just babbling about this, all these things kind of came up for me. But, you know, I just think, you know, how will you hear and express the teachings of Buddha in our time and place? You know, how will you write our sutra together? So, you know, that's probably enough said on this subject, bodhisattvas. So much more to say, but any comments? Yes.
Were Chinese Buddhists also part of it?
there were, but they were certainly not, they weren't relocated. So they weren't the enemy. The Japanese were the enemy, as far as I know. There were a few other people, like maybe suspect Germans and Italians, but the bulk of the Relocation Act was targeted against Japanese Buddhists, as far as I know. But it is true that, you know, there was plenty of kind of prejudice against, but at World War II, I think it was targeted towards.
What about Japanese Buddhists and Hawaii?
They were the first to go.
Were they relocated to?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Some of them actually formed a military division and fought with the U.S. government.
A lot of Japanese tried to pass as Chinese.
Did not go. Yeah. Right.
It was just exactly what this book is, telling the story, because we don't hear about things like that, sort of like witnessing things. Really. So I wanted to hear a little bit more. You mentioned yesterday about an exhibit.
Yes. So just to mention it, in the years I knew Kubosei, and we would have breakfast every Sunday, he never spoke about it. I had read in a book that he was in the camps. And it's very common. Japanese are humble, and, you know, there's a strong cultural tendency not to complain. Thank you very much. No complaints whatsoever. And so even in your dentist, he wasn't complaining. He was just going, oh, this is what happened.
Right. He said things like,
right. So you were both naturalists. So the Trickster Gallery. There's a Japanese American Service Committee, JASC, and on their website they have some resources. They're doing an oral history of this time. And there's a gallery in Schaumburg that I mentioned yesterday called the Trickster Gallery. And it's actually a Native American art gallery. And but they somehow have an exhibit and of up until, I think, May 4th, of artifacts and work. Some of it might be even artwork related to this time of internment. So thanks for sharing that about your dentist. Asian.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. You're reminding me of something that I read from Kodo Sawaki Roshi, Homeless Kodo, or the teachings of Homeless Kodo, where he, one of the things he says is, I want us to have like modern, you know, koans. I don't want these koans from, you know,
right,
these ancient times. And it just makes me think of, well, there's a quote from Suzuki Roshi where he says, you know, if you can see a 16-foot golden Buddha appreciate about you talking about this is that if we keep the teachings as something out there and like when I first started practicing, I wanted to try like all these Japanese customs, and then after a little while I was like, you know, this isn't really about playing at being Japanese. You know, how do we take this and make this, take what's over there and bring it here and make this part of our life? And so I think this is hugely important to be able to see teachings like that in our daily lives. And I love what you were saying about the, you know, the train moving from west to east. Mm-hmm. And how can we bring the teaching with us? I think that's like the most vital thing to maybe come out of that.
Right. I mean, it was very interesting to me that Kubose would wear a suit, and the way in which he conducted the situation with his Japanese congregants was much more Americanized than what the Americans wanted. And the great lesson of these Japanese people is they were 100% American and 100% Japanese Buddhists. And so they saw a way, you know, to manifest this. And not fetishize, but like blend in with our situation, you know. So I think, thank you for noticing that. That's my encouragement, is how do we make this practice our sutra, our prajna?
Michael. Thanks, Togetsu. I appreciate listening to your talk a lot. I was reminded while you were speaking of a line from that I was really taken with hearing and surprised to hear a line from the 8,000 line version of the Wisdom Sutras that was Fu Shoder had pointed out to us that says, call forth as much as you can
of love and respect and of faith. Listen to the words of the gentle Buddhas. Do what's the rest of it?
Clear away all your taints.
Clear away all your taints.
There's yeah. Like two more lines that I was trying to remember before I spoke up.
Yeah. So I was going to read that today, actually. So that's the beginning of the verse commentary. So there's two parts to the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita. There's the text, which is the 8,000 lines, that's with the Sahasrika, okay? And then there's a verse commentary that's an introduction. It's like many Buddhist sutras have verses that are like little poems in Sanskrit or Chinese, but they're typically Sanskrit, sort of. Anyway, those were because people remembered these. This is how it was transmitted. They weren't written, they were recited. And so they would make these sort of like cliff notes in poems of sutras. And so you'll see that in a lot of the sutras. And that's where this starts of. So call forth as much as you can of love and of faith and respect. Clear away all your taints. And something about hindrances maybe. Listen to the words of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, the well-being of the world. It's beautiful. That's how this sutra begins. So we talk about wisdom. Wisdom is compassion. The heart of wisdom is compassion. In the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is coursing, is immersed in this samadhi of perfect wisdom, of prajna, that is knowing beyond knowing before knowing. This is the bodhisattva of compassion. And also, by the way, in parentheses, Avalokiteshvara is like, you know, a gender-shifting bodhisattva, which is kind of cool. Sometimes a female, sometimes not. But, you know, there's this dialogue in the Heart Sutra between Shariputra, who represents kind of old-school Abhidhamma that had an idea that there were some fixed things called dharmas. And Avalokiteshvara received the teaching of emptiness, and emptiness is a term that means empty of inherent self-existence. It does not mean voidness. And in some translations that I think are better translations, that's how it's translated, not emptiness, but lack of inherent self-existence. That means lack of this fixed, unchanging self that says, this is me and this is some other. There's still, nothing changes when prajna occurs. It's just that that veil is lifted of separation, the fences, the walls come down. So, Michael, thank you.
Yeah, I was really taken. There were words you not typically hear around like that, or at least in the Buddhist context. And trust is something that has, become more and more important to me. And there are words that get mixed up or problematic, in the Western context, where they can be faith, trust, love, even respect.
What? Love.
Sort of, but like,
I think love is okay.
Yeah.
Faith.
Of course, but yeah. It's still, it's, I don't know. It's not, of course it's okay, but you don't hear it very often.
But maybe that will be our sutra. Maybe we'll have love. Maitreya, the Buddha of the future, is the Buddha of love and kindness. Sorry, I got so excited about hearing those words and that you heard them. Did you hear them at Tassajara?
Yes.
Whoa, how beautiful.
And that was the thing, is I heard them, but nobody seemed to know where they came from.
Yeah.
So I asked around, and that was the best someone could give me. I never got around to asking.
Yeah. I'll bring you,
It's the
Vajracchedika. It's not Vajracchedika, I'm sorry, Ratnaguna. What that commentary, that's part, it's a longer word, but it's known as the Ratna, which is jewel.
Yeah, it's just
Yes.
That's so supportive.
Thank you for the reminder of that time and those people. And I was also very moved by reading some of Nyozan Senzaki's own writings about that period of his life. And he was just so positive and continued, to, as you said, to teach in the midst of it. And it got to me, I've been thinking the last, as you were talking afterwards, about all of the people in very difficult situations socially under oppression and so forth, who have relied upon their religious or spiritual traditions and communities during those times. And I thought of Native American spirituality and the genocide, while the genocide was happening, and the African American gospel and slave situation, and even during Reconstruction and then during the Civil Rights Movement, how important it was, Martin Luther King being a Baptist preacher. And I thought about how, and certainly the Jewish, during World War II, the Holocaust, there's this role that the religious tradition and practice and community seems to play where it doesn't fix it.
No.
I mean, the Native Americans and African Americans were screwed. It didn't make it better.
Right.
And it didn't promise some kind of a fix, But, and it wasn't just a comfort, as religion is often portrayed. Right. It wasn't just a comfort to people. It did something to, it does something to, contextualize the situation. And I don't know what it does. It's hard for me to even describe, but it makes the situation, there's wisdom, this prajna that comes out of the circumstance, because you're engaging that terrible circumstance with your faith tradition, and something happens, and it's very profound, and it's it affects a lot of people.
Yes.
And I'm wondering right now, for us as Buddhists in the 21st century, we're in a difficult time.
Yes.
The environmental situation and world politics and economy and all kinds of things are potentially disastrous. And how might our Buddhist practice and tradition and community do the same for us that, you know, mm-hmm. Judaism did for Jews in the Holocaust. I mean, not to compare the two, but or African Americans, you know, they're in the civil rights movement. We're in difficult times, and how do we, or not just how to, I know how to apply it, we're applying it.
Right.
But what is it doing? And I'm curious about that. How did, mm-hmm. how does it help us? It doesn't fix the situation. It doesn't just comfort us. It does something. I don't know quite how to say what it does.
Well, yeah, so my hope it brings us together and also helps us to act from a place of love and wisdom, and that we have to sit a long time to be fully present with the suffering of the world. And, you know, face it, life has been tough. You know, there's been, it's never been, suffering's always existed. So, you know, and it seems like this time is full of dualism and danger and horrible things, but there is something about having this wellspring of faith. Aishin, you have a comment?
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I think it, along with faith, even just if we were able to teach everyone about the truth of cause and effect, that would be huge.
If people could get it.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
That's a very Buddhist concept.
Or the net of Indra. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
This fact of our deep, profound interconnectedness, and that it's just our own lack of vision that we see so much separation. But I feel like the only way we have a chance is if we can be stable enough, because the turbulence from suffering and from our own nervous systems that are caught in delusion is so strong. So how do we move beyond that? And that's not just sitting zazen facing the wall, but sometimes it helps to like put the snake in the bamboo tube, you know, to calm down a little bit so that we can meet somebody who's spewing hatred. Like these Japanese people were meeting these people who were like, you know, you're the enemy. I hate you. You know, the New York Times had like shocking words, things like, the hysteria was fanned by the media before and during the arrests of the priests. The Salinas newspaper featured news of the roundup on its front page, and the New York Times reported raids by federal agents and police in the Monterey Bay region had resulted in the arrest of 38 people, including, according to FBI agents, their best catch, a black-belted Buddhist priest who was thought to have, he had been a police official in Tokyo. The Times also noted the seizure of a lot of contraband. Life magazine's article was entitled U.S. Uproots Jap Aliens and featured a photo of the Salinas Buddhist Temple's bell platform minus the gong, because they thought the gong was going to signal the Japanese troops to come running over the California. So if they took our Han, you know. So the Buddhist, you know, people gave their things over. They said, here, please take this. It was painful for them. Some of them buried sutras in the ground. So, you know, somewhere in the ground in California are buried sutras from a family whose home was taken from them. So much. So to face that and see it from a perspective of a vision before we started to put up categories and walls, which is a natural part of our biology, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, is something that we learn and practice. This is the samadhi of prajna. And that samadhi isn't just when you're on your cushion. That's Senzaki's samadhi, saying, oh, I'm a friend to everyone. Anything else, bodhisattvas? Yes.
I don't want to make this about me, but it's been on my mind while we're hearing this. I was recently hospitalized for 42 days.
Hmm.
And I had extreme hallucinations. I'm tentatively diagnosed with schizotypal, which is on the schizophrenia spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was there, although it caused a lot of ruckus, I would always, I remembered that I was a Buddhist and that meditation was something to turn to, and cleaning was something to do as well, when there was an attempt to apologize to people in certain ways. And what I went through was nothing like a concentration camp, but hearing about the butterflies and seeking a kind of refuge in the darkest of times was really speaking to me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm happy you have this practice to help you with. So I do want to share one more thing, because I can't stop myself. And I know it's a little bit late, but along the lines of your combination, I too have been thinking lots about how do we, what is our practice as Americans today. You know, here I'm covered with all this fabric, right? But it to me is just, helps me remember the tradition. There's a Zen priest from, trained at San Francisco Zen Center, who is a Dharma Arab, Blanche Hartman, and her name is Zenju Earthlin Manuel. She's an African-American, lesbian-identified woman. And she has spoken and taught a lot. And if you ever get to read her materials, I recommend it. But she has some antidotes to hatred, some prayers or sutras. And I just thought I'd read one for us before we do our vows, if that's okay. So this is called The Heart of Tenderness. Tenderness has a wellspring beneath it. Draw from it to seek the good and obtain liberation. May that which we have suffered be a moment of our lives and not our whole lives. May we see what is truly in our own hearts without the distraction of imposed oppressive ideas of who others think we are. May our rage be felt, breathed, and attended to on the path of awakening so that we may recover from ignorance and hatred. Without words for what we have lost in prolonged mistreatment, let our grief lead us to an experience of well-being and sanity. May we regain the sight of the connectedness, the same connectedness we were born with as babies when our tongues touch the roof of our mouths. Whether we are talking, walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, let us draw upon the earth for ease and gentleness. Let our arms caress our innermost fears. And through this body, complete and perfect, its races, sexualities, and genders, let it be the gateway to enlightenment and to awaken collective awareness of our magnificence. So may it be so, bodhisattvas, and may we find our way as Americans to create our sutra.